CliffCentral.com.
Yes, Martika with Prince and Love Thy Will Be Done. CliffCentral.com. It is just after 7 o'clock and we are on a Tuesday morning. Pumi Mashiko and Mbulelo Tinta and Sia Sangweni, who's back in Gauteng after spending a couple of weeks, months, at the Sangweni Mansion in Eteguini. He's back. He's in South Africa. Isn't that exciting? He's in the real South Africa, not Durban.
Zululand. What are you trying to say about Durban?
Zululand. Did you just say Zululand?
Yeah, well, you were headed there.
Ah,
I helped you.
Well, please. Oh, that's hilarious.
I, for one, am sad that Sia left behind that gorgeous man that he used to jog to.
No, oh, you didn't hear. They had a fallout.
You didn't hear yesterday. Sia admitted that he embarrassed himself completely in front of the hot jogger man.
Mm. I missed yesterday.
Mm.
Yeah.
Please don't make me relive it. It's
no,
over.
Don't panic, Sia. Yeah, I mean, as far as anyone is concerned, you did what you needed to do, and now you've got back to Gauteng. There's nothing more that's keeping you in Durban.
Yeah, you know what? We had to split. It was, you know, it's the best decision for both of us.
Like you were ever together. It's hilarious.
As if he even knows what was plotting with me.
Oh, man. All right. Well, there are things to be discussed. I mean, yesterday, the other thing we got into that's a very real discussion, and it came up once or twice during the course of my day yesterday, is how difficult re-entry, and this is no pun on poor Richard Branson's rocket that didn't work, but how difficult re-entry is going to be for a lot of people in this country as we head back to work, and level three means more freeing up of people's time and the economy, and, you know, it means less curfews and all that stuff. Getting back out there is going to be tough for some people. They've become a little bit insulated and removed from society, and some people might just like it more than they admit. Get back out there is going to be a chore.
Putting on clothes is going to be a lot.
Putting on clothes is going to be a big deal. Like, suddenly we've all realized how comfortable track pants and, you know, someone said to me over the weekend that she's been wearing no underwear during the course of life. Yes, poor me. Yes. She's been wearing no underwear during the course of lockdown and she loves it.
Oh, no.
And this all coincides. This all coincides with the coldest time of the year, so it's going to be hard to pull people out of their houses.
Here's another episode of Judging with Pumi Mashiko.
Guys, just love yourself, man.
Go off, sis Pumi. What's wrong with not wearing underwear?
Just like loosely hanging about, Jay.
Well, if people can't have complete freedom outside, then they might as well have some complete freedom in their nether regions. That's what it's about.
Yeah, I'm with Pumi. Like, I wouldn't be able to.
People will be sharing how they haven't been brushing their teeth for days on end.
Ugh. Oh, okay. Let's not go down that road.
But it's the same.
But it's the same,
like,
thing.
It's self-maintenance, right?
It's just like, it's the same thing, Sia.
No, I don't know. Mm. How's that the same thing? The one you can get, like, you know, if your teeth rot, people used to die of things like that. Like, not wearing underwear is just a little bit uncouth. A little bit.
I don't feel, yeah, I just don't feel good about not wearing underwear. It's a personal thing for me. I'm not going to make a rule for anyone else like Pumi does, but I don't think that not wearing underwear is good. Yeah, it's bad. I don't like it.
The more I'm exposed to Pumi, the more the German comes out.
She could tell she went to a German school, huh? She's got rules.
Here's something interesting. I thought it was worth mentioning on the show here. There's an article that's been done around the trend of people buying more and more seeds during the lockdown. It seems like such a basic thing, But more and more people are opting to buy seeds, and I guess might be indicative of how we'll be living in the future. People growing their own vegetables from home, not relying on supermarkets, not relying on the outside world.
Yeah.
There's a particular main nursery chain in the United States which said over the past couple of months, they have seen their greatest growth in their 22-year history.
For seed sales?
For seeds, people buying seeds. They say they have had over 10,000 orders, up to 10 times what their norm used to be.
My goodness, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. We obviously are going into winter, so it's not the greatest time to plant seeds now. Am I wrong?
There are some that you can plant. There are some things that you can plant now because it takes, at seed level, because it takes about, you know, 6 to 8 weeks for them to start germinating, but you have to look after them. And we don't have very harsh winters. I mean, it's cold today and tomorrow, but mostly our winters are quite mild. So if you water your seedlings, your seeds and your seedlings, if you have them in a good position where they're not too exposed to the elements, you can get away with some stuff.
Is this going to be the next level of panic buying? Now it's going to be panic growing.
Yeah.
Panic growing is a great thing. You can't eat grass. So, you know, just if half your garden is not grass and it's stuff that you can eat, like carrots and
you.
Tomatoes.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. That sounds
and
sensible.
And herbs.
I've got friends who they've been planting stuff all, you know, since they moved into this house that they're in, and they've got quite a crop now. They can cook spinach, they've got lettuce, they've got cucumbers, they've got tomatoes, they've got everything. What I like, I've told you, I hate winter, right? I hate the cold. I'm not a fan of winter at all. But there are maybe four things that I like about winter. Number one is soup, and I made a beautiful veggie soup yesterday, which I haven't even tasted yet because you've got to give it at least a day. But it's nice. I can tell it's nice. Just from the smell, it's nice. So that's one. Soup is good in winter. The other thing is a fire, which I love. The third thing I like about winter is all the citrus fruit. And then I like going to sleep in winter. I don't know about you guys, but going to sleep in winter is my favorite thing because I like it when it's cold at night, when I can get into bed and like you get all cozy and then you go to sleep. That is nice.
Do you wear socks?
No, we've spoken about this.
Okay, don't. Anybody who wears socks when you sleep is you're a monster.
There's a lot of judgment in this morning's show. Sure.
I just did a little Google search, guys. Yeah. You know what you can also grow in winter? Garlic. Garlic, shallots, thyme, broad beans.
All right.
And these are good. Like thyme is a good one, hey, to have in your garden because it's a great herb. You can put in almost anything.
And garlic is meant to be good for everything. I mean, it makes you smell ungodly, but it's really good for your system.
Well, it keeps the vampires away.
Exactly, and who needs vampires?
Yes, and that. Yeah.
All right, I want to turn our attention because we've got a guest this morning on the show, Ralph Fletcher, who's no stranger to cliffcentral.com. But now more than ever, we all need inspiration and education from just about wherever we can find it, right? And I mean, some brain food for business is probably the most necessary thing of all. So have you caught up with our new podcast series? We only just started it. It's called Topco Business Unusual, and it is a must listen if you want a different perspective on how to make powerful business moves in these unprecedented times. Now, I know everybody's doing webinars and everybody's doing their own version of a show from home, but these guys are a professional entity that we've dealt with for a long time, and Ralph Fletcher is the host of the series. He's also the CEO of Topco. And we've decided to have him on this morning to tell us a little bit about it and ask him to shed some light on how important it is to get proactive rather than reactive in the business world. I love that, Ralph, because I'm so tired of hearing from clients and, oh, no, we're just going to wait for things to get a little bit more normal. Normal's not going to happen, right, Ralph?
Yeah, I think the new normal is here. And here to say, and thanks for inviting me on the show, everybody.
Sure.
So, morning to you, Pumi. Yeah.
Hello, Ralph.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Morning. Yeah, it's nice and frosty down here in Cape Town. So, I don't know how it is up there.
So, let's just talk, Ralph, quickly about the different and successful people in the world. And I mean, one of your focuses at Topco is that you really want to bring business, policy, and society together so that they can start having conversations about what the future will allow us to do differently.
And academia,
absolutely. So tell me first a little bit, for those people who don't know what your business is, tell me about Topco, because it's a really interesting company.
So I think what we do is, for 20 years now, we've been researching the top 10,000 companies in South Africa, and we award excellence and benchmark best practice. We do things like the top 500 companies. We do the Standard Bank Top Woman. We do Africa Tech Week. And essentially what we do is we bring ecosystems together and we share best practice. We shine a light on the organizations who are doing really well, and we try and share best practice with other organizations and really bring them forward into what the top companies are better organizing companies are doing, the thought leaders. And I think that what we're able to do is bring government and civil society on that journey. And for many years now, I think many people agree there's probably not a lot to celebrate in government, but actually we find there is. And with the amount of people that they employ, it's a pity really that there's a few people at the top who don't normally demonstrate the things that are happening on the ground. And so we try and find those pockets of excellence and shine a light on it. And I think it's no different now. I think that just our way of engaging with the audience has changed, modernized, almost like Cliff Central. It's sort of come out of the dark ages, so to say. And I think there's a perception, there's a number of media companies who have maybe not been able to make this transition. And I think that a lot of people are blaming COVID.
Yeah.
The reality is it's not just COVID. COVID is very severe, and it's really putting a spotlight on our issues, but it's not actually the main thing. Many media companies are known for many years. We've known for 10 years that we need to transition and change. And so we need to put our hands up and say we weren't brave enough, we weren't quick enough. And I think that probably goes for most organizations. We've been berating about digital transformation, around leadership. And I think the good thing is that we've seen so many organizations who now have pivoted 4, 6, 8 weeks have reached out and talking to customers in a different way on different platforms, and people who weren't even on WhatsApp and are now doing webinars and podcasts.
Yeah.
So,
Ralph,
we hate change, but we're good at it.
You raised two things here that I think are worth just exploring a little bit before we move on to the series that we wanted to talk to you about. The first thing is a lot of people blaming COVID. I mean, I see this happening. There are businesses that were already failing, and there are businesses that really probably didn't deserve to be in business before. And now they're suddenly finding themselves in a position where they can blame, you know, the lockdown and COVID for their demise. But there are also those businesses who just think extremely short term, and they just don't have any long-term plan, any strategy. And when something like COVID comes along, it catches those people off guard, right?
I think that what we're also seeing is a balanced approach. It's you need a short-term view and you need a long-term view. So I think that, you know, that's probably where a lot of arguments happen within organizations. You have different people, leadership styles, wanting different things. But in fact, what we need is a collaboration. We need both of those. And I think it's the and that's really important through COVID, and what we've seen is that you need to be changing the way you're thinking. So looking at your old customers and finding out new ways, understanding your old business, how can you bring it forward into the digital world?
What kind of feedback are you guys getting at Topco Media from the market at the moment? It's by no means easy out there, and it's fine for us to sit here and criticize, but we are going through probably the most difficult economic events of 100 years. And there are South African businesses that have been around for 100 years that are suddenly finding themselves without a future. So have you been speaking to leaders in the business world over the last while and gathering up some research and data around who's going to survive and who isn't?
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing is that those big organizations who are doing quite well, they're actually starting to pivot already to new business sectors. I think that the one thing that we realize is with a situation of this enormity, no one in the world has got experience. No one knows what the future really holds.
I think we're all guessing, to be fair. And I think that what we've realized is that we need to, for people in different organizations and the people within those organizations, we're all in different journeys as well. A lot of people are stressed out, yeah, anxious. And so really it's about how do you talk to people as people now, not really from Topico's perspective, but where they at, where they're at in their journey. I think it's clear that people really do want to do business. So there's this urge that South Africans want to do business against all the odds, and we're so dynamic and innovative. And I think sometimes they're just looking for innovative solutions. So they can't do necessarily what they did before because of the lockdown and other indicators. So they're looking for innovative ways how they can, you know, be mindful of a limited budget. And so I think it's about that. I think it's about the test and exploring phase more than it is like, we're definitely going to do this. And I think the people, the bigger organizations that we're talking to are certainly inspired for that. And I think that they know they've got to be leaders in that way as well. I think the mid to small organizations are at a different place right now, thinking of survival,
yeah,
helping them more than ever. We need to be inspiring them more. Who are brave, who got out there and left their organizations and started their businesses. These are the real heroes that helped. And I think that business understands that. They understand their role is to really help them. So I think that we're seeing already a little bit of a change of mindset from big business and certainly government. And but there needs to be more now.
So, Ralph, I mean, part of what you guys are doing is that you've launched this podcast series. We know that podcasting has taken off, especially during lockdown. We've seen a doubling of our audience during the time of the last 6 to 8 weeks, which is incredible. And I think it's because people don't trust the old media anymore. They know that they're being played for fools. They know that those people are after advertising revenue and not particularly interested in actually serving up the truth to audiences. Plus, in podcasting, you can tell the stories. You can actually explore the characters. You can get into the detail of it without having to worry about going to commercial breaks, news, traffic, weather, sport, and all of that stuff. But what's interesting about the series that you guys are doing, called Topco Business Unusual, is that you get to talk to some of the people who you would have brought out for an event effectively, and you are still planning events with these people. And these are some of the world leaders in thinking in innovative ways, coming up with great plans for business, tapping into the resources that are around you. Tell me about some of the people you want to host in the series.
Yeah, so I think that it's so true. I think that with challenges comes opportunities, and it's true. We had people, Salim Ishmael, who came out to South Africa last year, the executive dean of Singularity.
Mm-hmm.
And Singularity University, and then he started up a program called EXO, and we brought him out last year. And I think two things are really important. Number one is that, you know, when he came out, we had to bring him out, and it was quite a big expense for us. And I think we attracted like 300 people at the event, and it was a great networking event. But if I think now about what, I mean, he's done his own event, and he got over 2,000 people on a digital event.
Wow.
Where we had 300 people flying in from all over Africa to meet him. So I think that's the one thing. I think, you know, he didn't charge us for that podcast. So we were very fortunate, and we're able to obviously expose him to far more people. And I think that is the sort of way. I mean, we're talking to Standard Bank about our Top Woman program, and it really is around how do we take, where an event would have maybe 500 or 800 people there. We're talking like, how can we have thousands of women? And not just, I mean, physical events, the challenges you have. And I think Jeff Bezos, when he took over the Washington Post, sort of really defined that, which was, it was a great newspaper with great content. They had great journalists, a small community. And I think what digitization does is it allows you to serve a far greater audience. And so I think that, you know, you talk about moving across platforms. I don't know if journalism is changing. What we have to do and what the shift is just unpacking what it is that the community we're serving, what they're wanting.
Yeah.
And digital helps us do that. When you sell a magazine, it's very difficult to do that. I still believe in books. I had a big, you know, discussion with the three boys last night by, you know, YouTube, and we watched the Michael Jordan Netflix program.
Yeah.
But I said it's still important to read books.
Right.
Look, I think people need inspiration, and these videos and YouTubes and podcasts are great. I still think books are critical, but I think what digitization does is it allows us to help far more people and talk to far more people at their convenience, actually. I think the situation is. For us, we want to bring the greatest America but the world. I think that everybody knows that Africa is a place of great potential. And so now it's time to stop talking about that and to make that happen. We are endowed with some amazing people who have gone through some really tough times. Mm. And I think that we have so many great stories and journeys of successes, like from the golden era, past apartheid, who had nothing. And so we need to explore and share those stories and give inspiration to South Africans.
Well, Ralph, thanks for making some time available to us this morning. We're talking about a series which is on cliffcentral.com, and we've only done one of the episodes so far, and there's going to be a whole lot more. So Topco Business Unusual, it's the podcast series. You can find it on cliffcentral.com, and we'll obviously have some more of those coming up shortly. Don't forget our webinar today. We're doing something new and exciting. We're having a chat with Reg Lascaris, who is an absolute icon in the advertising world. We're also talking to Timothy Maurice, who you well know from cliffcentral.com. And we've got all the discussions that you will need to have around marketing in the post-COVID world, what that means, how you should do it, how you can save money, how you can do it more effectively, and what the best practice is all over the world. I know Reg has done a huge amount of research around this, and I know that that Timothy Maurice has been working hard as well to prepare a really interesting webinar. It's not going to be one of those boring Q&As between people who are uninformed. This is going to be something really, really special, and I want you to join us. So register today. Go to cliffcentral.com. The interview, the webinar, rather, is at 12 o'clock, so you need to get in quickly. Get it while it's hot. There are only a few places still available, and that's what we're planning to do today. Very cool. All right, Pumi and Sia and Mbulelo and I have lots more for you this morning, but we also have the next episode in our series Blind History coming up in just a short while. It's all about Emperor Charlemagne, who was really the founder of Western Europe as we knew it during the medieval era. Very exciting.
Oh.
Yes, very, very exciting. So what's on everybody's agenda for today? Besides our webinar.
The webinar.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, good point. First, I have to get acclimatized at Ginsburg.
As long as you're in underwear, my brother, we'll be okay.
Sia, please do not dream about going out in anything but the most excellent of outfits, or Pumi will be judging you. She's driving around Joburg today. I want everyone to know that Pumi may pull up at your house unannounced today and judge you, not only for your lack of underwear, but also for not having cleaned your house properly, for not having sorted your garbage, and all the other things.
She is the one who will have, like, the megaphone as she's driving. She'll roll down her window and just scream that out on the side.
In fact, maybe I should find that Casper and four police cars to like, hitch a ride.
Yeah, we found out this morning that one Casper or two Caspers and three or four police cars are the only sightings that White River in Mpumalanga and Boksburg in Gauteng have had throughout the course of lockdown.
Of the 72,000 SANDF deployees. Mm.
Those are the only ones that have actually been spotted, so don't take it too seriously.
Oh, of course, yeah.
No. All right.
Easy to me. Well, here's something. Do you guys remember a couple of ago we spoke about the oldest man, arguably, in South Africa and how he's dealing with the lockdown?
It's like 104 or something, right?
He was up there. I can't actually remember how old specifically he was.
No, he was. Doreen Morris tweeted a picture with him. It was a little bit older than
Western Cape, then.
Yes.
That's what I remember definitely. But the 113-year-old woman who lives in Spain, who has actually now even recovered from the coronavirus.
Well, sorry, just to give you the facts on that one. So it was Freddy Blom who we were talking about. He's 116,
and
he's,
oh my God.
Yeah. So
oh my God.
So this woman in this was in May, on May the 10th he turned 116. So that's pretty impressive. And his sister was actually killed by the Spanish flu. That's how old he is. Mm. So there's the link to Spain. So tell me about this woman who survived Corona, and she's in her hundreds.
113 years old. Her name is Maria Brañas.
Yeah.
And she was diagnosed with the virus after the country went into lockdown back in March. But after weeks in isolation, she has recovered and she's only suffered mild symptoms.
Yes.
At the timeline of her life, she has lived through the flu pandemic.
Spanish flu.
Back in 1918 and 1919. She lived through the Spanish Civil War back in 1936 to 1939.
General Franco.
And now she's lived and survived the coronavirus.
Unbelievable.
Listen, people who survived coronavirus have done some really cool stuff. Because y'all know I'm a big R&B fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Babyface survived coronavirus and gave us two of the most awesome Instagram Live musical tribute.
Only you can bring up Babyface confidently in the year 2020.
Yeah. Thank God for Babyface. That's all we need.
What? Babyface broke Instagram, y'all.
All right.
I mean, I can't take a man seriously who's pushing 60 or probably 60 plus and still has the name Babyface. Can he rebrand as Grandpa Face now?
You Oof. Wait, Sia. You'll get there
have
one
you
day.
Seen his face? Sia, have you seen his face? His face, even at pushing 60, is still up there. Face.
To that point, I'll be Botox face. Let me tell you now.
That was the weirdest thing. So while Pumi was trying to describe Babyface, all that happened was there was massive delay on her line. So all I heard was for Babyface's description. Horrible. Horrible. Okay, everybody. Well, we have a new episode of Blind History coming up for you now. The Emperor Charlemagne. His reign marks the end of the Dark Ages, the start of the medieval era. We have one more episode of season 3 after this. Is it just one or is it two? Let me think.
Been an awesome season.
It's been an awesome roller coaster. We had Eva Peron. We had Genghis Khan. We've had some real winners in this season. So make sure you don't miss this one. That's coming up next, Charlemagne. And then one more episode. And I think it's on the great composers. So Mozart, Beethoven, and Bach. Which should be really interesting.
Ooh, is Britney Spears also up there?
No, she's not one of the great composers. Yeah, Britney Spears.
I was going to say Mendoza.
Yeah, Mendoza and Britney Spears. Sorry, guys, just fell short. You know?
Yoko Ono, maybe?
No.
My last guest, Tyka Nelson?
No.
Oh, okay.
Tyka Nelson. Oh, boy. All right. Listen, have a happy day, and we'll see you at 12 o'clock for our webinar. If you haven't registered yet, go to cliffcentral.com today and sign up, because it's at 12 o'clock. You don't want to miss it. Some really interesting information, I think, is going to blow your mind and give you a little bit of perspective and a little bit of insight into what is coming up in the world of marketing and advertising. And God alone knows everybody's looking for answers. If you're going to find any answers, they're likeliest to come from Reg Lascaris and Timothy Maurice Webster. So hang around for that. All of it on the way at 12 o'clock today. But you have to be registered. We can only fit in, I think it's 2,000 people. So you need to make a move ASAP. All right, everybody, have a happy day. Here's Blind History, episode number 11, The Emperor Charlemagne. Imagine this as a dating site profile. Young man, 26, no formal education but can speak 3 languages. Currently in 3rd marriage, 4 kids, one of them a hunchback. Many illegitimate kids. Many. Ambitions to run the whole of Western Europe and unite Germany and France. No one would take that person seriously. But then, none of us live in 800 AD. That man is Charlemagne. First real king to emerge after the Dark Ages, and the founding father of all the European kingdoms. Charlemagne is the great emperor of the Romans. His reign signified, I think, the end of the Dark Ages, and for many people, the true beginning of the medieval era. He was emperor of Rome, but he was also known as the king of the Franks. He lived from about 748 AD to 814 AD. And during the early Middle Ages, he united the majority of Western and Central Europe. He was the first recognized emperor to rule from Western Europe since the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And the expanded Frankish state that Charlemagne founded is better known as the Carolingian Empire. He was later canonized by anti-Pope Pascal III, but he was crowned by the famous Pope Leo in Rome. So there's an interesting story about his ancestors, which we'll get to in a moment or two, but he has been called the father of Europe. He united, as I said earlier, most of Western Europe for the first time since the classical era, and united parts of Europe that had never been under Frankish or Roman rule. And it spurred the Carolingian Renaissance, which was a period of energetic cultural and intellectual activity within the Western Church, to which he was very closely allied. When he died in 814, he was laid to rest in the Aachen Cathedral, where you can still go and visit his shrine. That was where he was eventually buried. But in between is the part we're interested in. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host in Blind History, an official fan of history, a big history nerd like me, and also the MD of Taylor Blinds and Shutters, could only be Anthony Medra. How are you, sir?
Very well, and you, Gareth?
Awesome. I'm so pleased we're doing Charlemagne because I know he's one of your favorite ones. And I didn't realize when I went into doing the research around Charlemagne what a horrible time the 800s AD were.
Yeah, it was a very difficult time, and I think he was a big beacon, almost like a lighthouse. And people gravitated towards that. So he made a massive difference. But he is my favorite because, you know, it was born out of the fragmented and finally remnants of the Roman Empire, as you alluded to, especially the Western Roman Empire. And Gareth, just briefly, what I always like to look back at, where are their ancestry and where have they come from?
Mm.
And I found that extremely interesting and actually quite exciting.
Are you talking about his grandfather, Charles Martel, or are you talking even further back?
I'm talking further back, around the 400s, and we spoke about it in previous podcasts. So the Roman Empire was disintegrating with plagues and also the barbarians. So barbarians were termed by the Romans anybody that wasn't Roman. And Childeric, who was, inverted commas, a barbarian at the time, he basically was chief of what became the Franks and, you know, the loose set of tribes. But his son, and often they talk about his son, Clovis the First, as being the father of the Franks. And he basically pulled all of these tribes together into one relatively strong unit. And he was very, very successful. And he married a very, very strong lady with maybe an unfortunate name. I'm not sure. I think it was Clitoris.
What was her real name? Come on.
Clotildis.
How do you spell that?
Clotildis.
Apart from that horrible name, you've touched on one or two other things that are interesting. The tribe Franks, the Franks, are the people who eventually gave their name to France. That's where France gets its name from. And Clovis the First, who you mentioned just now, Clovis eventually in the Frankish dialect, which became French, the language, became Louis. So Clovis is actually Louis. And that name persisted through the French royal family right up to the 1900s. And I think actually the head of the Bourbon family now is also a Prince Louis. So it's amazing how Clovis leads to Louis and throughout French history was prominent. The other thing that's interesting is these kings you're talking about were called the Merovingians. And there is obviously Dan Brown in all of his books talks about the Merovingians because there was this fictional lineage of Jesus of Nazareth that is supposed to have found its ultimate fruit in the Merovingian kings of France. And while they started well, and you mentioned Clovis, they didn't end so well. They ended up being these simpering, weak, they called them faux kings. They were essentially just ceremonial. They were like puppets. And the people who really had the power in that time were the mayors of the palaces. And it turns out that Charlemagne's family comes from the mayors of the palaces of the two major provinces, which are called Neustria and Austrasia. Those sound like they're not places in France, but they're actually in northern France. And that's where the power came from, those mayors of the palaces. And Charlemagne's father, Pepin the Short, Pepin's another name that will come up a number of times during this discussion. He was the mayor of both of those palaces during the reign of the last Merovingian king, a really weak chap called Childeric III, who they eventually ended up sending to a monastery.
So it wasn't the lineage that started with Clover, but ultimately in the end it was Charles the Hammer, or Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne. He was actually very, very strong, hence the name Hammer, and he did a lot of conquering, especially when the Spanish tried to come into his area.
Well, you say the Spanish, but actually it was the Moors, and at that point Spain was largely a caliphate of the Muslim world, and that was controlled from Baghdad. And Charles Martel was the first real Christian leader in Western Europe to fight against the Ottomans or the Turks or the Muslims, the caliphate of the time. And that's how he made his name, Charles Martel. That was Charlemagne's grandfather.
Ultimately, in the end, it was a very strong lineage and not the weak aristocracy that came from Clovis I.
Absolutely. Now, Charles Martel might not have only lent his name to Charlemagne. He obviously gave him the reputation that the family would build on. But Charlemagne's name is interesting because his real name was obviously Charles as well. And that is the name for king in most countries. The Poles call their king Król, which comes from Karl. The Ukrainians, Korol. The Czechs, Kral. The Slovaks, Kral. The Hungarians, Királi. The Lithuanians, Karalis, the Latvians, Karals, and even the Macedonians, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, the Serbs and Croats, the Turks even say Krull for a king. Now, this develops parallels to the Caesars. You know, the term Caesar lent itself to Kaiser, to Tsar in Russia. And it's interesting that Charlemagne was the prototype for kingdom from that point on.
Yes, 100%. And incredibly, if we had to look at when he came in, he wasn't just a conqueror. He was true to form, a king. What was very, very important was his preservation of antiquity, loved to learn, converted most of Europe to Christianity, ultimately. And I think the biggest legacy of all, you know, people talk about him so much. Even Napoleon talked about him and Hitler talked about him, but the biggest legacy that he left was he took the seat of power of Europe back into the West and into the area of Germany and France, where historically it had always been out of Rome and later on Constantinople. And basically the whole geopolitical shift that was created by Charlemagne to bring the seat of power into Aachen, as you mentioned earlier, where he was buried. And just at that time, during those periods, the barbarian hinterland, or it was just seen as this dark, scary place with these tribes.
Constantly warring tribes, yeah.
Yeah, that would eat people and would worship strange animals. And so he changed that completely. And I think that's obviously very much where you get where he's the father of Europe.
You know, you mentioned something really important here, and that is that the context of the times were mixed. I mean, we look at the Middle Ages now, we see this period of chivalry. And while Charlemagne and his court eventually became the inspiration for the legends of King Arthur, and people don't know that, but that was part of what contributed to English myth and legend around what kingship was. It was a really awful time. I mean, you mentioned these warring tribes, but honestly, I mean, the women were as fearsome as the men. There was no learning. There was no real written language in Western Europe at that point, because the only people who could write were the monks, and they were mostly writing in Latin. People were as backward as, you know, we would look at prehistory now and say, how embarrassing that our ancestors were running around on all fours. But the Dark Ages were not a great period for Europe. And quite apart from all the violence and the nastiness of this constantly warring part of the world, there was no established hierarchy. There was no established law. There was no established religion. So you've got to imagine that coming out of that, Charlemagne made a massive impression on the world. He managed to drag a bunch of barbarians, as you and the Romans call them, into a period of some civilization.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, standardizing currency, serious improvement of agriculture and trade. He pulled Europe out of the Dark Ages, as you rightfully said earlier. He was that beacon of light and a massively powerful individual that changed the course of history.
You also mentioned how he put such an emphasis on education, and he himself was well educated and could speak probably three languages. His children were all raised in especially his daughters, actually, because at that stage, women were really, you know, not taken terribly seriously. But he raised them the way his parents had raised him. And they were taught skills in accord with their aristocratic status. So they were trained in the men anyway in riding and weaponry and embroidery, spinning and weaving for his daughters, and also language, philosophy, history.
You mentioned a little bit earlier his dad, Pippin. Pippin the First was actually Pippin the Third, which became very confusing. But he was the first king. They were mayors of the palace, the other Pippins, Charles Martel's dad and granddad. But he was called Pippin the Short, and people don't really know. He wasn't that short. They say he could be the younger. He kept his hair short because they liked the hair long. There's lots of different reasons why he was called Pippin the Short. But Charlemagne himself, and they verified it when they opened his tomb, was over 6 foot. They reckon around 6'2". So tall, broad-shouldered, but had a shrill voice, which often surprised people.
So he looked like Al Gore, but he sounded like Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. That's what I think of him.
Well, he had a son. You talk about physical attributes. His eldest son, with a woman called Himmeltrude, not a great name either. His son was called Pippin the Hunchback, his eldest son, and he did have a hunchback. And as a result of that hunchback, they say that he may have been counted out of the succession. It turns out that Pippin the Hunchback's story is not as beautiful as Charlemagne's, and I'll very quickly give you a précis of that. He basically was living in his father's court. He was the eldest son, and for a long time, Charlemagne showed him affection and care. He was even considered as one of the successors, but he made the mistake of rebelling against his father. He tried to organize a coup and actually tried to have Charlemagne murdered, and one of Charlemagne's servants told him about this, and so he held a trial. All these people who'd broken their oath of office to serve the king, they were all executed except Pippin the Hunchback, who was sent off to a monastery. This seems to have been a kind of punishment at that time. You were what they called tonsured. In other words, they would take you, they'd shave most of your hair off, they'd leave you with that funny donut of hair that you've seen in medieval paintings, and they'd send you to a monastery where you would spend your last days praying, worshipping, and transcribing the Bible.
And what was the tough side of Charlemagne with regards to when we talk about the monks and we talk about religion was that they were very, very strict at that time. If you didn't go to church on a particular day, there was capital punishment.
No, it'd kill you.
Or if there wasn't tithe, they could kill you. Or if you didn't contribute volunteering to not mow the lawn, cut the grass or whatever it is, they could kill you. So it was actually very serious. They were very, very strict on religion and how you practiced it.
Well, for people who think that Islam is the more violent of the religions, I will assure you that at this time, Islam was the more open, the more civilized, the more intellectually aware, the more the far more thoughtful of the religions at this point, because Christianity was behaving in the worst possible sense, and Islam was civilizing the Western world in some ways. I mean, if it wasn't for Baghdad keeping many of the classical records, we wouldn't know about so much of ancient Rome and Greece. So it's an interesting comparison to make for those who like to look at religious history. But to go back to Charlemagne, he obviously spent much of his reign, as most kings at that stage did, and going around conquering other people and trying to keep his empire together, right?
Yeah, 100% correct. Early on, he suffered one defeat. He went into the Saracens, which is northern Spain, and against the Saracens, and they managed to reach an agreement. So Charlemagne turned around, took his army back out of what is Spain today, through the Pyrenees, and he went through a narrow pass, and then he was attacked, not by the Saracens, but by another tribe. And his nephew, Roland, was killed. And there's a big epic that's come around that. It's actually the Song of Roland, which has come out of that. And they used to sing that when they used to go on crusades much later on. They used that almost like Homer and Troy. But it was like the fake news of that period, because what they said in the ode was Charlemagne came back and avenged the death of Roland. But actually he didn't. He wasn't in the area. He didn't go back.
So in other words, propaganda.
100%, yes.
He did conquer the Lombard kingdom, and this is interesting because the Lombards were in the north of Italy, Liguria and that area. And obviously, this was a big deal because those parts of the world had fallen into disarray after the collapse of the Roman Empire. And the Pope played an important role in Charlemagne's life. I mean, Pope Leo famously crowned him
on Christmas Day in the year 800. You couldn't wish for a more auspicious number than that. And this was a very big deal. Pope Leo III had been assaulted by some Romans. They were actually going to put out his eyes and tear out his tongue. Nice people. And he escaped and fled to Charlemagne. Charlemagne was outraged by this and decided, no, he's going to go back to Rome, reinstall this pope. And the pope, almost as a reward to Charlemagne, but also to increase his own power as the head of the papacy, decided to arrange an elaborate coronation in the Vatican, which he then held with crowns and jewels. And Charlemagne was actually very much opposed to this idea. He didn't like the idea of a big spectacle. He apparently never wore ostentatious outfits. He would dress up when he had to for, you know, high Christian days and so on. But this was not his favorite thing to do. So both he and the Pope, by doing this, obviously increased their power. Ceremony was a hugely evocative thing in those days. As we discussed already, people were very religious. So by Charlemagne doing this with the Pope, they almost created a new normal for Europe.
If we read into that, yes, Charlemagne was definitely looking for power, like so many of our great people in history. But he had a different side in that he had this divine purpose, and that was critical to him. So the angle of the Holy Roman Emperor, I think, sat very easily on his head. And it was apt because he felt that was one of his main purposes in his life, was to bring Christianity to as many places as possible.
Yeah, I think that Charlemagne in that moment probably took control of destiny. And, you know, there's an interesting thing that happens in genealogy, which is one of my other hobbies. That's the tracing of family trees. One of the great achievements in genealogy is being able to show that you descend from Charlemagne. And many, in fact, probably all of the royal houses of Europe today trace their origins to Charlemagne in the 800s AD. It's a very long time ago, and it's got to a point where that's almost like the goal of most genealogists, is to get to that. There are volumes of books published on the descendants of Charlemagne. I've actually got a few of them in my library here, and the guy at the front of it says, "This book is not a superficial collection of elaborate pedigrees. It contains the true facts in regard to the names known in history and of many families who have contributed in some way, great or small, to the development of our culture, progress, and government. Furthermore, in these pages there may be found corrections of a multitude of errors without challenge in other genealogical works." And then he goes on to say that this is really the high point of what genealogists try to achieve. So he was the fountain of all of that stuff, which is still held in such high regard in Europe now.
I think, Gareth, that what he'd built and set up didn't last very long, but the legacy was massive. You know, after Louis the Pious, his son, took over, it just fell apart.
He had a number of wives and a number of concubines and a number of descendants, but you just mentioned Louis the Pious, who was the only real heir left at the end of the day, the only legitimate one anyway. Some of these names are absolutely dreadful. Rortrud, Bertha, Gisela, Hildegard, Himmeltrud, which I already mentioned. Some of the names, his brother Carloman, that was also the name of one of his sons, who was renamed as Pepin, King of Italy. Lulegard, some of these names are really, give you an idea again of the times. And it didn't sound like French then, and it didn't sound like German then. And Charlemagne was probably the only time in history that Germany and France were under one king.
He had four wives and tons of mistresses. I think that was like in those days. But he didn't let his daughters marry. He overlooked all their affairs, but he didn't let their daughters marry. I think mainly because of dilution of power, and he was worried what the impact would be. And I think he really tried hard, Gareth, in building a legacy. Louis became co-emperor with him shortly before his death. So he really tried to provide, you know, a platform to go forward into the future.
He's buried, as you already said, in Aachen, which in the French language they call Aix-la-Chapelle. And you can actually go and see his shrine, which is there. It's a gold and silver chest in which his body lies. But there is also an arm reliquary in which there's an arm bone of Charlemagne's, which is regarded as holy because he was sanctified later on by a pope. And it's amazing that someone that lived 1,300 years ago, effectively, can still be such an important influence on what eventually became the EU. I mean, you know, in many ways, Belgium was also part of his empire, and the place where Europe is run from is just a few kilometers north of where Charlemagne is buried and where he was born. It's interesting that the European Union might eventually prove to be the ultimate fruit of his loins.
The other point, as an example that I mentioned a little bit earlier, was Napoleon. He said, "I am Charlemagne." And the Nazis used it in different ways. Initially, they used it as propaganda because, you know, Charlemagne wasn't a saint. I suppose he was in the end, but he ordered the execution of 4,500 Saxons in 782. And so the Nazis used that as serious propaganda. But also, on the other hand, they named one of the fighting troops after Charlemagne. I think they call it the Schutzstaffel, which was the SS during World War II, was named the Charlemagne Regiment down in France. So very interesting. People still speak about him so highly.
Yeah, they say that all modern Europeans are highly likely to share Charlemagne as a common ancestor. That was actually discussed in an episode of QI not so long ago. Ultimately, if you are of Western European stock, you probably have a bit of Charlemagne in
you. Or Genghis.
Or Genghis. So that links to our previous episode, which I think is fascinating. There he is, Charlemagne, the father of Europe, Pater Europiae. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I remember in the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade movie, you remember Indiana Jones's father, Henry, he uses his umbrella to induce a flock of seagulls to smash through the glass cockpit of a pursuing German fighter plane. So he says there, "I suddenly remembered my Charlemagne. Let my armies be the rocks and the trees and the birds in the sky." Now, despite this popularity of this quote since the movie, there's no actual evidence that he actually said this, but it's nice to think that he might have. And the interesting thing about Charlemagne, excuse me, this dog is scratching at the door. Just hold on. Carl, what are you doing? Little shit.
The dog's name is Carl.
I know, named after Charlemagne.
Exactly, because the Germans call him Carl.
Carl der Große, yeah.
Yeah.
Carl the Small is the one who interrupted us. CliffCentral.com.